This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our TV show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. The epidemic of police violence in the U.S. continued over the past week, with the news of two horrific events. In Columbus, Ohio, police fatally shot a 13-year-old African-American boy named Tyree King, who was holding a BB gun in an incident reminiscent of the Tamir Rice killing in Cleveland. And in Tulsa, Oklahoma, police shot and killed an African-American man named Terrence Crutcher, who was peacefully following orders and being followed by several armed officers when he was brutally shot. It is these killings that are inspiring a growing wave of symbolic nonviolent activism by athletes around the country. NFL football player Colin Kaepernick sparked the trend of sitting through the playing of the national anthem some weeks ago in an action that has now multiplied among fellow professional athletes and even college and high school players. Some are sitting down, others are kneeling, and a few are even raising their fists as the anthem plays before their games. My guest is Chenjerai Kumanyika. He is an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University in South Carolina and a correspondent for Rising Up. He's been closely following the stories of these national anthem protests. Welcome to the program, Chenjerai.
Hi, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
First, let's, of course, talk about these two incidents of police violence that have happened just over the past several days, which is exactly the phenomenon, the representative of the phenomenon that is being protested. First, the killing of this child in Ohio. I mentioned Tamir Rice. The similarities are eerie. It's happened in the same state, although in different cities. As far as you know, is the killing of Tyree King just as uncalled for as Tamir Rice's killing?
Yes, the case of Tyree King is tragic, as was the case of Tamir Rice. And, you know, Tamir, it's sad that this would happen again in Ohio, in Columbus, because the Tamir Rice case is one of the cases that really just speaks to the injustice here. I mean, here you have, I believe, Ohio is an open carry state, actually, and you have a 12-year-old boy, and, you know, we have clear example of the police lying about the case. And then you have, you know, very similar circumstances here in Columbus with Tyree King. And it's just tragic. And then, and that's in Ohio. And then there's this other case as well.
Right. And in fact, in the Tyree King killing, police were showing a photograph of the BB gun, which of course does strikingly look like a real gun, as if to say that the killing of this child was justified. I mean, even if a child was holding a loaded weapon, to shoot first before trying to save the boy's life is just a remarkable thing. And certainly it remains to be seen how that case will unfold, if any charges will be brought. In Tamir Rice's case, none were brought. What about Terrence Crutcher, Chenjerai? In the last day or so, the video footage of his killing, brutal, horrific to watch footage, was released. From what you see, what can you tell about what happened?
Well, you know, I watched this tape. I watched multiple camera angles of this tape. And, you know, that doesn't make me an expert. I wasn't there. But what's clear is, you know, this man was unarmed. He had his hands in the air. And he, as far as I could see, for the majority of what you see on the tape, he appears to be cooperating with the police. And, in the police record, they said, you know, their statement was that he started after them. And, you know, there's no evidence of that on the tape, that he was walking towards them or anything. He was up against the car. And so for him to be killed, first hit with a stun gun and then killed, the idea that this man couldn't find a way to arrest him without killing him is absolutely absurd. And I think a lot of people are recognizing it. One element that I think is really, that has to come out both in the Tamir Rice case and in the Terrence Crutcher case, in the Tyree King case, I'm not sure of the extent in that case, but this situation where we have police officers lying in the initial report, I feel that often as we try to move toward indictment, the fact that they actually lie and completely obstruct the process of justice, that gets lost. I mean, because when you talk about the idea of a system that's not working. You know, we police officers who are lying in the initial reports about this has to come up.
Right. Already they're revealing that they're not to be trusted in that act of deception. And it comes up over and over and over again. It certainly doesn't seem to be a case of a bad apple, maybe a barrel full of rotten apples with a few good ones might be a better analogy. And it just seems to be remarkable that this continues to happen. So these two incidents, so horrifyingly commonplace in the United States today, is at least in part what Colin Kaepernick, the NFL football player, said when he first sat down through the national anthem some weeks ago. And that was a very, of course, important symbolic act. And he made very clear that he thinks it is absolutely wrong for police to go without being held to account. He basically said, I'm not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color. There are bodies in the street and people getting paid leave and getting away with murder. Are you kind of blown away by how his protest has seemed to spread like wildfire? I can't even keep track of how many athletes are now following suit.
Oh, well, you know, I could help you.
yeah, let's go through it.
All the way back to a long history of protest. I mean, you know, Tommy Smith and John Carlos and Peter Norman, Muhammad Ali. But more recently, Alton Sterling and Philando Castile case, we had WNBA players protesting the Lynx, and officers walked out in response or refused to, you know, be at the game in response to their protest. Then you have Kaepernick, right? You have Megan Rapinoe with the Seattle Reign. You have Brandon Marshall with the Denver Broncos. You have Jarrell Casey with the Tennessee Titans. You have Martellus Bennett and cornerback DeKevin McCourty with the Patriots. You have Marcus Peters with the Kansas City Chiefs. You have Arian Foster, Kenny Stills, and Michael Thomas, Angelani Jenkins with the Dolphins, and the owner expressing support there, and the Rams with Robert Quinn and Kenny Britt. So, and I can't forget Simone Manuel as well in August with her comments after her victory in swimming. And that's just, you know, kind of on the professional level. There's numerous high schools, so it really has caught fire.
What about at your own university, Clemson University? Tell us what happened.
Well, you know, first of all, let me just say, you know, as a professor at this university, I would never pressure any players to take any particular acts of protest. I think that you know, I know many of the athletes. I have some athletes in my classes, and you know, I just, you know, in class I do my job and teach them what I'm supposed to teach them, but you know, some people have raised questions and wonder, since Clemson does have the spotlight that it has, will players use this to express whatever their political views may be? There was an interesting way that Coach Dabo Swinney was asked this in a press conference. Someone asked him if he would discipline players for sitting during the national anthem. Now, of course, we don't play the national anthem before our game. Well, we play it. I think the players are in the locker room. They have not come out yet. But Dabo Swinney responded to that in a very strange way.
Right. He invoked the legacy of Martin Luther King to basically say that athletes should not use their free speech rights to protest. And this is all in the context of Clemson University athletes not actually having engaged in any protest. This was a hypothetical question that he was asked at a press conference. And you responded by telling Coach Swinney, this is a coach at your university, a very well-paid coach at your university. You responded by writing him an open letter telling him to take MLK's name out of his mouth. Tell us a little bit about what you felt you needed to say to this coach when you heard this reaction. And we hear this is a very sort of common thing when especially around Black Lives Matter. We've heard over the past few years people basically saying it's fine for you to protest these killings and these injustices, but just do it, you know, don't disrupt people's lives, or don't be so open about your protest. So it's a common theme. What exactly did you tell Dabo Swinney?
Well, first of all, let me just say a few things. You know, Dabo Swinney is, from all accounts, I don't know him personally, but I've heard that he's a good man. He cares about players. And, I mean, this is really, you know, I have a lot of testimony to that fact, And I know that he does a lot. He's also a wealthy man, certainly one of the highest paid state employees, as I understand. But he's, you know, he does a lot with his wealth to help people in various ways, you know, and some of that includes different ways that he helps black people. So I don't want to characterize him as a villain. But, you know, his comments when he started, and actually when he initially said he would not punish players, and I applauded that. I was very careful to make sure that I applauded that in the letter and sort of talk about what I agreed with. But then he started to, but then he said that he did think that not standing for the national anthem was wrong. He made the bizarre false equivalency that somehow two wrongs don't make a right, equating injustice with protesting injustice. And he then went on to try to use Dr. King's legacy to back that point up, and then also his religious views. And I thought that Dr. King part was completely unacceptable. And so, you know, my take is that I don't think that Dabo Swinney probably is very familiar with some of the more radical writings of Dr. King, like the Letter from Birmingham Jail or Beyond Vietnam speech and things like this, and or the Trumpet for Justice speech. And I think that he, at the same time, I think that, you know, he is part of a tradition, whether he intended to be or not, of trying to actually use MLK's legacy to silence protest, to invoke this sort of dreamer version of MLK who's just holding hands and swinging back and forth and everything's just about love and peace.
Right, as if his protest was something that just was more convenient and palatable to Americans rather than, you know, being somebody who inspired people to rise up and who himself was arrested multiple times for nonviolent civil disobedience.
Beaten. And as you point, yes, and as you point out, I mean, not at all convenient or not at all the kind of person who was waiting to do things in the appropriate venue, because that was kind of what Swinney was saying. Like, I'm all for protest, but you should do it in the proper venue. And I mean, I think that was precisely the opposite of what Dr. King said. And so he argued this in the Letter from a Birmingham Jail. And I just kind of did a very close reading comparing Swinney's comments to the Birmingham Jail and basically saying, look, you know, you should feel free to disagree with Dr. King. Maybe you disagree with him. And if that's if you do, that's totally fine. But don't invoke his name to back up this idea that was actually the opposite of what he died for.
And so, Chenjerai, your letter went viral. And of course, predictably, you were also attacked. Just as athletes who are kneeling or sitting or raising their fists through the anthems are being attacked by everyone from internet trolls to police unions, you yourself, I understand, got some hate mail and even a threat against your family.
That's true. Yes. I mean, you know, again, I'm not at all here to paint myself as a victim. You know, I feel relatively safe. And I also want to say that, you know, in the Clemson community, you know, I've gotten tremendous response to the letter. And, you know, not all the responses are times where people agree, but, you know, productive invitations for us to just talk and parse this out. But there also has been a significant number of, you know, just hate trolling kind of messages. I'm a racist thug. I'm an idiot. Ironically, you know, you can even tell that people didn't really read what I wrote because they're just like, you're being divisive. You're this, you're that. It's as if I just completely insulted Dabo Swinney's character. And yes, we did get an email that suggests that in which my family members were named and they said, you know, we're coming after you, you racist pig. So, you know, that, and you know, you just kind of think, what? I understand that we may disagree when it comes to this issue of protest, but I wrote a very well thought out, you know, piece to Dabo Swinney that was simply about the way he used Martin Luther King. I didn't disparage his character. I also talked about some of the other problems in South Carolina, and he didn't. And the fact that that letter would warrant the kind of vitriol that we've seen really shows you how invested people are in preserving the status quo.
And of course, the protests themselves among athletes spreading. First of all, it's remarkable that we play the national anthem constantly before games, you know, from the high school level all the way through professional games. You know, if you sort of think about it, it doesn't really make much sense to have that even play. And as we've pointed out, and others have pointed out previously, the missing verse from that anthem celebrates Americans, the American practice of slavery, which is just sort of conveniently swept under the rug. Now, how much impact do you think these athlete protests are having? Do you think that they can help start the conversation? You know, it seems as though these athletes are using whatever they have at their disposal, their star power, et cetera, in the arena that makes the most sense, just as Black Lives Matter activists are doing their work in the streets. Do you think that these protests are going to have some kind of impact?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think one thing that's about the nature of this particular kind of protest is that it is something that is very much in the spotlight because sports is in the spotlight. And as long as the sports season goes and people continue to protest, it's going to remain in the spotlight. So, you know, this really is an interesting tactic because it rather than trying to get media to pay attention to a protest that's happening sort of in places where people aren't normally paying attention, this is taking it right to where people are always tuned in multiple times a week. And also, you know, and so then we're seeing that be replicated even, like I said, at the high school level and these other places. So I think that just the ability to sustain it and the reach of it and the way that it promotes a conversation about our relationship to these national symbols and ultimately to the concept of the nation and patriotism and all these things, I think it's a tremendous intervention. Mm-hmm. I don't think it does everything. I think it needs to be followed up and supported by the kinds of claims that you see being put out by, you know, Black Lives Matter as policy, by Black Youth Project and many, many other organizations.
Well, it seems as though it's a very effective single prong of a multi-prong strategy. You know, it's pretty amazing to see sort of, you know, different people in different capacities participate in calling for justice and saying that Black Lives Matter, even, you know, if not explicitly, then implicitly through their actions. Finally, Chenjerai, I want to end our conversation today by following up on a related story around injustice against, in particular, Black children. A year ago, we had covered the story with you in South Carolina of the police brutality of a South Carolina high school student caught on film, the Spring Valley High School, where a young girl was just incredibly brutalized by a police officer while in the classroom. And I understand that you have an update for us on this story, which has dropped out of the national radar. It was a year ago, October 2015, when it was caught on camera and it garnered widespread national attention. What has happened to that story now? Has that young girl seen justice?
Well, she has not seen justice. But here's what's happened. On August 10th, there was, the DOJ had been talking to the Richland County Sheriff's Department, and that was the Sheriff's Department that Officer Ben Fields was fired from after his essentially assault on the student. Now, on August 10th, the DOJ reached a settlement that sheriff's department would overhaul its entire practice. So that was a positive step, much, much more so than simply firing. But what we were trying to see is that the problem was that even at that time, the only person who had charges placed against them were the girl who was actually attacked, amazingly, and another young lady by the name of Nia Kinney, who stood up and protested. And they had charges. Officer Fields still right now has no charges. And so another update that happened a couple of weeks ago was that county solicitor said that he will not file charges against Ben Fields. And he released a statement at that time that gave us even more insight into this case. One of the things that we learned was that, I mean, really what you see in this solicitor's report, where the solicitor should be essentially setting up the grounds for prosecution for Ben Fields, what he does is you can see he and the sheriff's department sort of working together to make sure Ben Fields is not charged and kind of cherry picking comments from the statements of different people that paint the incident in a light, you know, in a sort of more you know, less, you know, bad light.
Right. So we know this sort of proves that our criminal justice system is set up to be almost always biased in favor of police, no matter what police themselves say when they paint themselves as victims, even if they are the brutalizers. We see them getting off time and again because there seems to be this, you know, bias built into the system towards police.
Absolutely. I mean, it's when that incident was circulating, if you just take your mind back to the images of this girl being slammed and thrown across the floor. Everybody, it seemed like, a clear case. It's captured on camera, multiple camera angles. The girl is thrown. It's like, come on, this is not just a case for him to be fired, but this is assault. And when he was fired, the case for assault seems like it goes gets even stronger. But in fact, what happened was, fortunately, the charges on the young ladies were dropped. But also, we find that we're not going to get charges on Ben Fields. Another quick update that happened was that the Department of Education released rubrics to schools, and they referenced the Spring Valley situation about how schools should deal with police officers. And on the surface, this appeared to be something that was like a positive step because they recommend that schools involve the community and that they have a whole process involved, you know, and trying to make sure that these kind of incidents don't happen. But when upon closer scrutiny, what you find is that these rubrics really are more about keeping officers in the schools and maybe even putting more officers in schools in some cases. The rubric speaks explicitly to that. When community groups are saying, you know, we should be getting officers out of the schools and get counselors in the schools, people who are actually trained to deal with problems with classroom management and some of the special needs that students might have.
And so our government essentially continues to then reinforce the presence of police in schools. Again, another bias in favor of police, no matter what the evidence is showing police to be a negative force in our various institutions. Chandra, I always appreciate your remarks, your insight on our program and on these issues. I know we'll have you back on the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali. Thanks for having me.
My guest is Chenjerai Kumanyika, an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University in South Carolina and a regular correspondent on Rising Up with Sonali. We'll post a link to his viral letter, open letter to Coach Dabo Swinney at Clemson. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can sign up for our electronic newsletter online at risingupwithsonali.com to receive emails with links to all our interviews.